Hello, listeners. Welcome to Human Rights Unscripted. Before we begin, I'm pleased to announce that the Human Rights Brief, Volume 27.1, has been published and is available now. This newest volume includes insightful articles about the prevention of torture, the repatriation of North Korean refugees, and a detailed analysis of the human rights violations inherent in female genital mutilation. It also provides a review of cases from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights and the European Court of Human Rights. As you can tell, this volume provides a very thoughtful look at some of the most important issues in international human rights law today. To read the volume free of charge, go to our Instagram page at WCL Human Rights Brief or visit our website, hrbrief.org. And now, on to our interview. Welcome to Human Rights Unscripted. The following interview was conducted by our staffer, Christine Cha, with Professor Ezra Rosser. Ezra Rosser is a professor at American University Washington College of Law. He has taught courses in federal Indian law, poverty law, land use, housing law, wills, trusts, and estates, and property law. He is the author of A Nation Within, Navajo Land and Economic Development, published by Cambridge University Press in 2021. He's a past chair of the AALS Property Law, Poverty Law, and Indian Nations and Indigenous Peoples sections. His articles have appeared in journals, including the California Law Review, the Harvard Law and Policy Review, Washington University Law Review, Yale Human Rights and Development Law Journal, Environmental Law, and the American Indian Law Review. Thanks for listening and enjoy the interview.
Can you start by talking about what drove you to federal Indian law and poverty law?
Great. So I grew up, I'm white, and Navajos have a, I grew up in part on the Navajo reservation, and they have a word for white people, which is Bilagana, which means it's been translated to me as white, the other, or the enemy. And that's a fair description of white people on the reservation. They have about 2% of the population is white. And my dad was a teacher, and he remarried a Navajo woman. And my mother was a bus driver, and then she started working for the tribe for tribal economic development. So that's the personal connection. But I only was there for actually school 2 years, and then I left for boarding school. And my parents now, my mother, when she retired, she wasn't married in, so she had no place to live. So she left the reservation and now is a bus driver someplace else. And my dad continues to live on the reservation because he's married in. So that's the sort of connection with the Indian law side. And then on the poverty side, and I've written about this in a parody article called On Becoming Professor, I grew up relatively poor. My dad was a carpenter for a while and before becoming a teacher, and my mom was a bus driver before becoming an environmentalist. And so we didn't have a lot, and so that really drove me to care about poverty.
Thank you. Can we start by discussing Arizona versus Navajo Nation? Can you talk about the case and what it means for water rights, as well as federal Indian rights more broadly?
Yeah, so I was involved, and I should I'm not sure, not a caveat, but a description. I wrote one of the amicus briefs on the case. I did a amicus brief that was about the connection between the treaties and the water rights claim. I did that with two other professors. The challenge on the case really was that if you take the winter's rights seriously, and winter's rights are this doctrine within federal Indian law that says that Indians have a right to enough water to support the reservation for the purpose for which it was founded. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically you need water to have a reservation be successful. And if you take the winter's doctrine seriously, then Navajos, this should have been an easy case, because what the Navajos were asking for was pretty simple. It was, we need the government to do an accounting of the water in order for us to know how much rights we have. Before we can do anything, you have to know what you are expected, what your rights under the trust are. And that really is easy. I teach a wills, trusts, and estates class here, and one of the fundamental parts of trust law is that no matter what other things you don't have a right to, you usually have a right to an accounting. So That should have been easy. The problem with that case was it was conflicting with another case called Jicarilla. And in Jicarilla, it said that the federal government only owed a trust obligation if there was a that was enforceable by the tribes if there was a statute allowing it to be enforced. So it really undercut the idea of a general trust obligation in favor of a legislatively created and limited trust obligation. And the Supreme Court went the Jicarilla route. Technically, Winters still survived, and it did, but it's hard to know what to do with it if you're not allowed to get an accounting. And now the dissent I thought was great, not just because they cited me, but I thought the dissent was a great dissent because it did say, here's all the ways Winters survives, but it was a blow for tribes for sure.
What are your thoughts on the tension between poverty and environmental sustainability in Indigenous nations? Is this something people in the academic community are thinking about?
Yeah, so I've written a couple of things about this. My book has this a fair amount. I have a book called A Nation Within, Navajo Land and Economic Development, and that has stuff on this. And then I also wrote a way too long paper, I think it was a 110-page Law Review article that was read by three people, and my mother and one other person and myself on this as well. But the basic thing that I say in both sources is, you know, tribes, just like non-Indians, have a mixture of views. Tribes have a mixture of views. And so I think that it's very tempting for environmentalists in particular to adopt a stereotyped version of Indians that says, you know, earth protectors or whatever. And there is a degree of truth to that, but there's also other people who do other things. And so in particular, the tribe that I know the best, the Navajos, we could see this in their policy with regard to, say, mining. So recently, the Navajo Generating Station, which was powered by Navajo and Hopi coal, shut down. They tore down the Navajo Generating Station. It was very dramatic. It was the tallest building in Arizona for a while, the smokestack. It came down, and it looked like, in some ways, that the tribe was moving to a greener future as far as renewable energy. But the tribe also, at the very same time, a tribal entity, which was a Navajo Transitional Energy Corporation, they purchased three mining companies off reservation. So they sort of doubled down on coal mining. And so tribes are not monolithic. There are a lot of different views within tribes and across tribes on how to deal with the challenge we all face, which is development and the need to protect the environment.
I feel like, Professor, it's one thing about environmentalism as applied to like Indian nations is it just seems to look such a strange push to stop some of the least developed communities and some of the people who face like the highest rates of poverty in the country. I guess this might be a little outside the scope of what we usually talk about. Do you think there's a way that environmental groups can better engage with Indian nations?
Yeah, so the article I talked about that nobody has read, that has it a little bit. I think one of the things that I was annoyed by with environmental groups, and I should say, obviously, climate change is real. Coal doesn't help. We should all care about these things. I was writing about in the context of a proposed power plant that was going to be on the Navajo Nation called Desert Rock that was going to contribute, I think, 1/10 of New Mexico's pollution, just that one plant. So it was a major polluter. And nevertheless, what bothered me was the environmental groups relying upon federal preemption and federal authority to block the tribes. To me, that was environmental groups sort of leaning into colonialism when it suited them. They didn't want to see it that way. They would see it as, well, they're part of the United States, and so they're subject to this EPA rule. But that, too, is the same thing. So I was bothered by that. I think the better route for some of these environmental groups is, at least at the first stage, lean into tribal politics and tribal rights and listen to tribal members who have needs. You know, I think one of the challenges here that relates to both environment and poverty is I don't believe that we would tolerate this level of poverty for any other group of Americans. And so the fact that we are okay with Navajos living with 50% unemployment per capita, that's around 1/3 to 1/4 of the rest of the United States.
I was wondering, compared to the past 10 years, do you think there's more awareness now about that, the fact that Indigenous sovereignty is not respected and that we should care more, and that the fact that we allow the rate of poverty and the issues that reservations face, do you think it's more common in the academic sphere to talk about, or is it still a big issue?
Yeah, so this is a challenge. It's hard to figure out. Each of the spheres matter. So I will say, within law schools, we're in this moment, and who knows how long it will be, where schools are recognizing the need to even teach Indian law. And so a lot of lateral movement. So if professors are getting hired to go to other schools because they do Indian law, native professors. And that's a remarkable development, that it's attractive enough that schools are taking an interest in deciding to hire people for that purpose. When I was hired here, I was hired to teach property. And I happened to do Indian law. But now schools are thinking it's worth hiring people for this. So that's great. And I would say, in general society, you know, there are some indications that there are more attention, right? So Killers of the Flower Moon, the This Land podcast, there are sort of attention to these details. Even the murdered and missing Indigenous women's issues has gotten a fair amount of play in the media. On the other hand, we can think back. So this is taking me too far back. Whenever I ask students if they've seen this movie, they now say no. But Dances with Wolves had a similar phenomenon. So Dances with Wolves did that for that generation at some point. It made attention to the existence and the continued existence of Indians. Where I think we're at is that, as I said, sort of in my answer to poverty, is we're still at the stage where we see Indians the way we want to see them rather than the way they are. And so they're no longer invisible. And if you go to the museum here in D.C., one of the major exhibits of the permanent exhibits is an exhibit based on the idea that we still exist. And so that message, I think, is out there. But the idea that tribes might differ from U.S. norms and that that's okay, that is problematic. And I would say that that is problematic for the left and the right. If tribes do something that is not in line with progressive values, progressives don't like that and think tribes should have to give way, and vice versa. For and the same is true for conservative ideas.
So what I think I'm hearing is that it's important to support Indigenous people in all aspects of society, to allow the legal side to move forward in a more substantial way.
Yeah, I guess. Well, I don't know that I would. So the legal part is one aspect. I don't know that the law has done much of the movement over the last 5 years. I think Black Lives Matter deserves a lot of the credit for, you know, if I look at the number of students taking my class today, it was 30 the last time I taught it this last semester. That's a big number for Indian law. And I think that's Black Lives Matter. I don't think it's Indian focus. Most of those students didn't know anything about Indians, but they do know that minorities matter and they want to learn more.
So in researching for this interview, we saw a piece you wrote about romanticism surrounding Indigenous nations and the environment. We've already kind of covered it, but can you go a little bit more into it?
Yeah, so, you know, the famous one was this Crying Indian ad. And in the Crying Indian ad, it gave the idea that we basically have held to since then, that Indians love the environment and that Indians would be better, it'd be better if they took over a lot of environmental protection and just leave it to the Indians and things will get better. And to some degree, of course, that's true. So there have been one of the sort of more exciting spaces within environmental law right now and the overlap with Indian issues is the federal government and states giving tribes a role in co-management. And co-management with heavy tribal leadership seems to work for a lot of these resources because the definition of the sort of how many fish should be left in the river or whatever it is, the tribes place a different value on that, and that value tends to respect the species more. So I'm not saying it's not true. I think the danger is thinking that that's all there is. You know, and I think we see this mainly on things that we have the same conflict as well. So tribal members drive big trucks. That doesn't mean they don't like the environment. It doesn't mean they don't like their homeland, but they also drive big trucks. Non-Indians, you know, that I like to think of all the celebrities that are big pro-environment flying their private plane different places, right? So we are all conflicted characters with multiple motivations, and Indians are as well.
I'm just curious, Professor. I don't know if you happen to know this, so feel free to just pass. Do you know if anything in like the Inflation Reduction Act was sort of targeted at giving resources to different Indian nations to maybe like develop in an environmentally friendly way?
I believe there was. I mean, I the ones I know better are the CARES Act, which gave a lot of money to tribes. I think the inflation reduction, I think it did, but I don't know the details. Mm-hmm. That, you know, one of the things that's certainly true for the Navajo, and this is somewhat of a duck, but COVID actually provided this just flood of federal money. And that flood of federal money has continued through the Biden administration as well. And I don't know if it was targeted for Indians or Indians were just an eligible beneficiary of that flood of money. And it allowed, in some ways, for the Navajos, for example, they were facing this crisis of no longer getting mining royalties. And so the crisis was going to lead to arguably a reduction in the size of the tribal government. This flood of money allows that crisis moment to be pushed off further. And, you know, I think one of the things that I'd like to say for both Trump and Biden is that they both believe in spending money. So Trump spent money when a crisis happened. Biden spent money as a way to get over the crisis. That's why our economy is doing so strong, is that both parties spent a lot of money. Now, they spent it in different ways, but they both, in some ways that should make conservatives uncomfortable, are Keynesian. They believe in pushing money on the people.
How do you think international human rights law should look at Indian nations, and how do you think the U.S. has handled those international human rights laws?
Yeah, I think the good news on this is that there's where the best progress is being made. The question is, of course, enforceability and significance. But as far as the law itself, and I really credit Kristen Carpenter at Colorado and Angela Riley at UCLA, as well as Rob Williams and Jim Anaya, Rob's at Arizona and Anaya's at Colorado, for really pushing this and heightening awareness of this within the Indian law space. But the stuff included in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People is great and should inform policy much more than it does. So I think the international law space is, that's where we're seeing real values being expressed by Indigenous peoples and then made into some sort of law. Obviously, the future would be something more binding than just a declaration, and ideally some domestic courts paying attention to it. But as far as its ability to inform what we should want, I think there's value. I mean, one of the challenges always is we see just the Indigenous peoples in there as defined by their colonial larger government. But some of the struggles facing Canadian natives are the same, natives, First Nations in Canada are the same as Indian nations in the U.S., is the same as the Ainu in Japan, and the same as lots of Indigenous groups face similar pressures. So the more we can bring attention to the ways states are failing them, I think there's value there.
Can you just, for our audience's sake, just sort of talk a little bit about what's in the declaration? And like, obviously, you know, the U.S., there's like, you know, a policy part of the U.S. that would have to adopt this into national law, but just sort of generally, like, what are people pushing for?
Generally, there's everything. I mean, that's the beauty of the declaration, is that if you have an issue where an Indigenous group is being wronged by the state or the federal government or by non-Indians, chances are there's something in the declaration that responds to that deprivation, right? So there are things about rights to land, there are things about rights to culture, about rights to language, about rights to independent governance. There are all sorts about rights to define their own membership. So basically on any topic that you can think of, it will be relevant. Now, that doesn't mean lawyers should necessarily bring it up. If the courts aren't going to listen, it may do a disservice to their clients to bring them up. But there is certainly a relevant principle of international law as found in the declaration, as well as there's some through the ILO as well and other places. Our school was head for a long time by Claudio Grossman, who did a major role in the first case recognizing the rights of Indigenous peoples over land, which is Awastini. And so there are, within international law, relevant either provisions or norms that should apply to any dispute involving natives.
For our listeners, can you explain what ILO
is? Yeah, I think it's the International Labor Organization, but they have these sections which recognize Indigenous people's rights. They were actually one of the early movers to recognize Indigenous people's rights as a thing under international law. So right now, most of the work is all involving the implementation of the declaration, and that makes sense. as well as some litigation through, say, the Inter-American Human Rights process. Nevertheless, it's significant, I think, it's significant that they recognized it. And the other place that we're seeing, and David Hunter at our school has worked on this, is some of these international organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, whether they have to take into account indigenous, say, right to consult when they're thinking about different projects that are funded by the bank or by the IMF.
What solutions would you suggest for the government, indigenous rights groups, and others to better address some of these issues?
Yeah, I think the larger problem is, and again, not a law problem so much as we have yet to really recognize the degree to which our control over natives is a continued function of colonialism. And so right now there's a fair amount of debate and people talking about, well, should the settler colonial discussion be applied to, say, Gaza, Palestine, or Israel, Palestine, or Gaza, or other places. But one place where it clearly can be used is the way in which the United States interacts with tribes. And so even there, we are reluctant to admit that. So we are a classic settler colonial society, and we continue to exercise authority over tribes in line with a Eurocentric notion of what governance should be and who is better as a government. And until we start to recognize that that is behind our power grab, not much progress realistically is possible. I think from the U.S. side, I think the other thing I would say is, and this is really from a book called Blood Struggle by Charles Wilkinson, tribes, to their credit, even in a very constrained environment, have found ways to secure to themselves more power and more rights to determine their own path forward. And so it's easy in all of these conversations to get depressed. You know, we started with Arizona v. Navajo Nation. That's a depressing thing. And there's a lot of depressing cases. Castro Huerta is a very depressing case. There are bad things happening, but there's also a degree to which the tribes have managed to create what has been called measured separatism. So a existence that continues to this day to be different from the larger society. And in the face of the genocidal pressure that was imposed upon them, that's a tremendous success story.
We've talked a lot how the legal realm is not necessarily the realm that's pushed this change, but internationally, yes. In terms of domestically in the United States, how do you see lawyers or the legal realm helping community organizers, grassroots organizers, organizations that's already doing the groundwork?
Yeah, I mean, I think in tribes, the difference I would say is the primary mover is the tribal government. And so one thing that remains true to this day is that many tribes are desperate to have lawyers. I tell my students, if you are willing to move to the reservation, I can find you a job. And that remains largely true that to this day, tribes are in need of legal assistance. They're happy to take non-Indians that have such skills as well. Obviously, it'd be better if they were tribal members, but there is a space for tribes to better exercise and more fully exercise their governance authority. And I would really encourage anybody that's interested in this, consider working for a tribe on a reservation for a while. I think it does a couple of things. One of the things is it provides some legitimacy to your beliefs, some idea that you understand what life on a reservation is like. It also shows that your ability to deal with a constrained environment, right? Tribes are not in a position to demand everything that they want, but they're also not powerless.
What advice do you have for law students beyond working for tribal governments? But what advice do you have for law students at AU or elsewhere who are interested in advocating for these people?
Yeah, I have two thoughts. One is that, especially at AU, we are not going to have many Native students. The Native students that get into our school will also go to Arizona. And that makes sense, and that's fine. I would say what that means is that the students that I encounter at schools like this, and this is going to be true at a lot of law schools, are going to be non-Natives interested in it. And the two things that are contradictory that I always think about for non-Natives. One is there is a space for non-Natives to help. And that can be hard to imagine because we want Natives to be in the driver's seat on this, but there is still a need for lawyers, and there's a need is great enough that non-Indians can play a role. I think of some of my graduates who are working for the tribe, and I think they're doing good work, and they've been there a long time. On the other hand, the contradictory part is you need to remain humble. And that has to be not just humble because you know or don't know, but humble about what your place should be. So even if you do know or think you know better, it's not your place to say. So those things, I think, are hard for lawyers. I think in law school, my own view of it differs by school. Some schools aren't this way. But I think at AU, we spend a year breaking students down and 2 years bringing them back up so that hopefully by the time they graduate, they're feeling pretty confident in themselves. They need to have some of that humility brought back. And luckily, the work environment often will provide that space.
As a member of Peel and a member of the different environmental organizations on campus, yeah. I was wondering how Peel could be a better space.
I think Peel's been great. So, you know, all credit to both the students that are involved in NALSA, as well as to the Peel staff, Ingrid, David, Bill Snape, and before that, Amanda. I think of Peel as being very helpful. They've been very supportive of things that are led by some of these NALSA groups, like the Navajo Spring Break trip, as well as stuff like the Fed Bar Association, which is very important for school, for students to work toward jobs on this. I think Peel's doing great. I think one of the things on this, and I think this is also true on the courses, if students are interested in my class, Indian Law, they should also probably be interested in Bill Snape's class on public lands. They should be interested in David Hunter's classes. So I think there's a lot of overlap. I don't know that I would ask any more of Peel. I think the other thing I would say related to students that have these interests is that you need some flexibility on what you do after you graduate because you need a job, and that will require some flexibility. On the other hand, when I think about the students I've had that are happiest with life 10 years out, they tend to be the ones that compromise the least on what they wanted to do and stuck to what they came to law school for. So everyone makes changes as they go through law school, and we all have to pay a mortgage or whatever the equivalent of pay off your student loans. But on the other hand, to the degree to which you can remember why you came to law school, you'll probably be happier.
That was all the questions we had for you. But is there anything else you want to talk about while I've got you here? Anything no. You want to plug or anything well, like
I
would, that?
Well, the one thing I haven't said that I should say, which is when you're new to this field, I think it can be intimidating to know to reach out to people or not. My experience, certainly within the Indian law academic community, but I think it's in general true, is that if you show a sincere commitment to improving the lives of tribal members or tribal communities, you will be welcomed. And if you have questions, people will happily help you through things. You will make mistakes, but you will also be recognized as part of that community that cares. And so don't be afraid to reach out to people.
Are the tribes fairly interconnected in the way that they all know each other and kind of keep in contact with each other?
It really depends by tribe. So, you know, one of the things that some tribes have, especially Oklahoma, where the U.S. government pushed a lot of tribes together, including former enemies together in the same reservations, some of those will be more involved in, say, powwow culture, where there's a lot of crossover from tribes. Other tribes, you know, if you grew up in the middle of nowhere, you know, the middle of the reservation on the Navajo Nation or on Hopi, and you may not have a lot of contacts with a lot of other tribes. So it really does depend.
Do you think there's more opportunity possibly for tribes to come together more as a unified front?
Well, so, you know, one of the things that's interesting on this is there are some spaces where that's already happening. So one example is there are some tribal courts, appellate courts, that are being done in a pan-Indian way. So multiple tribes are then creating a pan-Indian sort of appellate court. And that's great, you know, if that's what's needed because these tribes are pretty small. But it won't be the appropriate solution for all tribes. I would also say on this, you know, not united front or not, if that's going to happen, then there has to be careful. It has to be careful on how you decide to exclude people. So this is perhaps a little beyond the scope of this podcast, but National Congress of American Indian is going through this right now on whether they include state recognized tribes or not. That's a contentious issue. I mean, there are a lot of very contentious issues. Another is disenrollment. These issues, which are happening on some reservations, are very problematic for the tribal members who are being kicked out. And so it's not as if every answer is going to be clean and nice.
As someone who really sees the benefit of academia in the role of creating and expanding the narrative that people can bring to the table that colonialist settler mindsets would be more accepting of, do you see that there's more support or there is support for Indigenous peoples who want to get into the various different fields of academia so they can say their piece about the different ways society?
Yeah, we're in a good moment for natives as far as, but it's hard to know whether it's coming from the institution or coming from themselves. That's what another part I would say is that we're seeing more natives who have the right training, have the right degrees needed to get those jobs in academic spaces. And they're getting those jobs. Every time this happens, you have to be concerned about like pretendians or people pretending to be native and taking up space that should really go to a native person. But that's happening. I think the only thing I'd say is there's a push and a pull factor. So schools are recognizing the need for it, but also tribal members are showing that they can bring a lot to that space.
So during our 200 plus history as a country, there's progress, but it's not nearly the level that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I said earlier, I just don't think we would be okay mm-hmm. with people having lives as impacted negatively in poverty or lack of running water, even if they were not native. And so that says to me that we have a long way to go.
Thanks for speaking with us, Professor Rosser.
Thank you all.
This has been an episode of Human Rights Unscripted, a podcast from the American University Washington College of Law. Please subscribe on Spotify for more episodes as they come out. And please follow the Human Rights Brief on Instagram @WCL Human Rights Brief. Thanks so much for listening.